Okay. So I don't need to do but very fast on the general paradigm of gamma ray bursts. I mean, it seems that they're stellar cataclysmic events. Long bursts seem to be associated with massive stellar collapses. Short bursts appear to be connected with compact mergers. There is very good evidence for these. There is some increasing evidence for these, but it's not definitive. There might be a third group of bursts there, which you know, it's unclear what they are. And of course, then the assumption is that, you know, a black hole forms in either the collapse or the merger. There's an accretion event going on for a while. You sort of look at the relativistic fluid equations, you put in some approximations, you know, and then you have sort of Landau-Lifschitz type of calculations to do, and you find that, you know, there will be, if you put in enough energy into a small enough region with little enough baryons in it, so little enough mass, then initially the Lorentz factor grows linearly with radius, and eventually it saturates to a value where the, you know, the flow becomes sub-relativistic in its own rest frame, so that a lot of the internal energy that you generated near the center gets converted into bulk kinetic energy out here. And then the flow is sort of cold in its rest frame, but it's running at very high velocity. Then at some point it would become optically thin and it would radiate, but that's not good enough. There is not enough radiation energy in it and it's thermal. But if you have shocks, which is expected, there will be collisionless shocks. If you don't have internal shocks, you'll probably have magnetic dissipation, like reconnection or so on and so forth. But, you know, the standard simple paradigm, fluid paradigm, is that you have internal shocks where faster regions catch up with slower ones. There is some difference of Lorentz factor, so they collide at some radius, which may be of the order of 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 centimeters, depending on the variability time scale, which typically is of the order of milliseconds, the minimum value, the Kepler time scale around the inner orbit of a few solar mass black hole. And there's a function of Lorentz factor, which is inferred to be of the order of hundreds. So you can get internal shocks there that make gamma rays, and then eventually you'll also, everything runs into an external medium, you get an external shock where you reconvert, you know, much of that bulk kinetic energy into radiation. And thereafter, so here's the internal shock, thereafter in the external shock, the Lorentz factor drops as an inverse power law, generally minus 3/2 if adiabatic conditions apply. And so if you're producing radiation here, it turns out to be it's in the gamma ray range, and here it would be, you know, depending on the magnetic field, it would be gamma rays, and as it slows down, you predict that you'll have a, you know, less and less Doppler shift, so that you predict an afterglow, X-ray optical radio, and, you know, Paczynski already had predicted that you would get a radio afterglow if the thing had slowed down weeks later. So you expect these afterglow, and of course these afterglow is something that was found. So here's for the massive stellar collapse paradigm, here's, you know, you'd have the envelope falling in, the black hole, the jet, internal shocks, and the afterglow. So all these is sort of stuff that has been done over the past 10, 12 years. And then, you know, synchrotron and inverse Compton calculations on the shock predict that you'll have, you know, a forward shock which produces synchrotron, which might be in the MeV to X-ray range, a reverse shock, because, you know, in the ejector you have a reverse shock just as in supernova remnants, which emits in the electron volt, the optical range, and then there is an inverse Compton component, which might be in the GeV range. And So the synchrotron and inverse Compton spectra parallels and they soften in time. So all these just, you know, quickly going over what was known and done with Beppo-Sachs. And now with Swift, we've had a whole new of results. The 90 new afterglows, by now it's 110 new afterglows, and they keep coming at the rate of a couple a week. There are redshifts now for more than 20, so these are a little bit a few weeks out of date. And there are redshifts for, I think now, 5 short gamma ray bursts. And as you know, one of the things is that the redshift, the mean redshift of the long gamma ray burst, it's 2 or 3 times that which was found with Beppo-Sachs. And this is explained by the fact that the gamma ray detector of Swift is more sensitive than that of Beppo-Sachs and BATS, in fact. So that on average, you find, you know, you most of the bursts you find are the ones that are at the limit. That's where you have the most volume. And of course, being out there, they're fainter and redder. So you do find the X-rays and the gamma rays easily, but, you know, the redshifts are a little bit harder to find. And especially the UVOT, which is only a 30 centimeter little thing, is not all that capable of finding, you know, the UVOT image of the burst. Also, the UVOT doesn't go any redder than 6,500 angstroms. So it, you know, things that are at high redshift, you know, is not sensitive to. It's more blue. Now, the X-ray light curves, of course, the fast slewing of Swift is what allows one to find new features in the range of 100 seconds to hours, which previously with Beppo-Sachs one had to wait, you know, 4 or 5 hours until it slewed. Swift slews in less than 100 seconds, so you acquire the X-ray light curves in less than 100 seconds. And so the most interesting new features have come with the XRT observations. Both in long and in short bursts, one finds features which were, in a sense, they were known from Beppo-Sachs, but they were known in a few bursts and they didn't appear to be generic. But now it appears that there is a generic appearance of very steep initial X-ray decays, and in some cases very shallow, it's followed by a very shallow decay. And then the intense X-ray flares in this range of 100 to 10 to the 4 seconds. So as I say, these are not entirely new because some of it had been seen with Beppo-Sachs, but, you know, in one burst here and one burst there, you know, and so you said, oh, well, it's an oddball. Now you find that, you know, the oddballs are coming in groups. You find many, many oddballs of these type, many oddballs of that type. So you're beginning to see that these actually a generic picture. And some of it appears to be evidence for, you know, seems to be due to continued activity of the outflow. So the outflow continues being fed, apparently, for periods of minutes and hours, which previously it had been thought, you know, might be needed, or, you know, it had been thought of that one had refresh shocks. I mean, refresh shocks date back to 1998, the Beppo-Sachs era. That's, you know, when some shallow light curves were seen and, you know, people thought, well, you know, refresh shocks might explain it. Now one is sort of, it's not, you don't sort of have to invoke it for one burst, you have to invoke it for quite a few bursts. So it becomes, it seems to be, you know, that there is more need for it. It's more generic. So a generic type of light curve, which doesn't mean that all of them are like that, but, you know, that many of them do have one or more of these features. So let's say 30 or 40% of bursts have some initial X-ray. So let's say this is where XRT switches on. XRT switches on generally at around 100 seconds. Before that, there was, of course, the gamma ray emission, okay, the back prompt gamma ray emissions, which I sort of, that's sort of not all that unusual compared to BATSE. So I'm not talking too much about that right now. So initially, in you know, almost half the burst, but 30-40%, there is this very steep initial decay, t to the minus 3. Sometimes it looks like t to the minus 4 or 5. And then in many bursts, again, 30-40%, there is the shallow decay, which is flattish, so minus 0.5 in time or minus 0.2 in some cases. So it's not an adiabatic, simple adiabatic expansion. And these is the old behavior known from Beppo-Sachs, a decay which is minus 1.2, 1.5. And then if there is a jet, there is a jet break, which, you know, looks like that. So that part was known, but this part is the new one. And then, you know, the worst or, you know, the most sort of glaring thing is that there are flares, large X-ray flares, sometimes just several small ones. But sometimes there is a light curve which just comes from here. There is no steep decay. There is just a, let's see, there is just a more or less normal decay like that. So this doesn't occur in all of them. Sometimes, you know, a normal decay starts from here, or there is a featureless decay. But when there is a steep drop and a shallow portion, then generally there are flares. If there are no flares and no steep decay and shallow decay, then, you know, the light curve seems to fill this region here in a smooth way. So it's an interesting sort of... almost sort of you use up your energy one way or another. Now, with this prompt follow-up, or relatively prompt follow-up, it becomes more important to have a more quantitative description or understanding of when the afterglow starts and when the prompt emission stops. And in fact, you know, it's somewhat difficult because you know, the afterglow may start while the prompt emission is still going on if there are two different regions. The standard interpretation is that the afterglow starts when the ejecta, the outer part of the ejecta has started to decelerate, and enough of it has started to decelerate that you start, you know, getting this parallel asymptotic behavior. And that occurs at some time, deceleration time, which in observer coordinates is the radius, the observer coordinate, observer radius, and then 2c over gamma squared, 1 plus z, and there is some factor here which depends on how you match the asymptotic solution to the prompt solution analytically. Numerically, it's rather messy to understand that, but, you know, analytically you more or less sort of get it. But it's all still at the level where you sort of feel more confident playing with the analytical things along the line of sight than with doing numerical calculations. So roughly, it would start at 100 seconds, modulo the isotropic equivalent total energy and the external density in cc's, and the Lorentz factor in units of 100. The prompt duration is associated, if it's internal shocks or if it's, you know, reconnection or whatever, it's associated with stuff that goes on while the outflow is going, and the outflow maybe at some point stops the bulk of its, pulling out the bulk of its energy. It may do some late stuff, but, you know, maybe it stops the bulk of its stuff, of its putting out energy after some time, which is, you know, generally called T90, the time during which 90% of the energy was ejected. And during that time, the gamma rays are on. So depending on whether the ejecta material can be considered thin, namely the duration of the ejecta is less than the deceleration time, then the afterglow starts at this time. But sometimes the ejecta continues being put out for a longer time, in which case the afterglow starts really after you have stopped ejecting matter. So it's
the energy in all those things is the isotropic energy.
Well, you put here the isotropic energy because in the relativistic dynamics, as long as as long as any collimation angle is larger than the causal angle, you can consider it as if it were isotropic. So you put in a fake, you can do all the calculations with a fake isotropic equivalent energy, but typically the actual energy, once you measure a collimation angle, is more like 51 ergs. Okay, and these sometimes gets, the isotropic equivalent sometimes gets to be 54. It's not the whole energy, it's collimated, but the isotropic equivalent, is, so it is parameterized there, and that number can vary by several orders of magnitude. So here's data on one of the bursts, fast decay, shallow slope, normal decay, what looks like a jet break. These are all in X-rays. Previous, these are all the XRT behavior. And I should say, that the jet, what looks like a jet break here in X-rays, does look like a jet break, but there is no guarantee that it's an actual jet break because we have no guarantee that it's an achromatic break in the light curve. It's simple to interpret such a break like that and the slopes agree if you have observations at many wavelengths, let's say in optical, in previous, 5 years ago, Frail et al. And the Bepersack, many such breaks were observed in optical at many wave bands, and they all occurred at the same point in the different wave bands. So one felt comfortable that these are geometrical effect has to do with viewing the it's easily interpreted as the light cone size having become equal to the jet size, then you get these achromatic break. Here we only have the X-ray evidence. And in one or two cases, there's been a separate radio observation at one wave band and an optical observation at one wave band, but one is missing or the other is missing. So we don't have the full confidence that these are honest jet breaks. There are several X-ray breaks, and they probably are jet breaks, but it's not guaranteed. Now, as far as the interpretation of the initial steep drop, the point is that it goes as t to the minus alpha, but it depends a little bit on what the starting time is that you put there. Now, in principle, a very steep break could be, the very initial steep drop could be that, maybe there was a very early jet break. So it would be hard to get something which is as steep as t to the minus 3, but, in principle, after the jet break, the slope goes as t to the minus the electron index, p. And if p is 3, which is a little steep but not crazy, you could say, okay, it can go as t to the minus 3. But that would mean that you get a jet break at 100 seconds. That means you have a jet angle of, 0.5 or 0.1 degrees. So it's a crazily narrow little jet. So you might have more of them. It's a little artificial, so it's uncomfortable. I mean, you could argue that it's patchy, so you have a jet which is made of many of such spikes, but then you have to, you have to play around with probabilities of being in a spike, etc. So it all doesn't look too good. There is another possibility, which is that when you have the jet propagating through the star in the long bursts, initially the jet is inside and it's sort of being slowed down by the star, so there is these raised relativistic gas, which is spilling over as the head advances, just as in AGNs, you have a cocoon around the jet, a cocoon of sort of thermal relativistic gas. So here you would have this cocoon of waste heat, which as the jet breaks out, the cocoon starts to expand, and when the cocoon becomes optically thin, you might get actually a steep initial X-ray spectrum. And Asaf Peres has done some calculations on these. There is a paper in preparation. It's a possibility. Currently, the more widely favored view is that these very steep initial drop is due to seeing the high latitude emission, or sometimes it's called the curvature effect. So it's radiation which is coming from outside the light cone, but still inside the jet. So from angles greater than 1/γ, but still inside the jet angle. That radiation arrives later, at some time later, by that factor relative to the line of sight radiation, and it's softer by a Doppler factor, which is inversely proportional to the time. And Kumar and Panaitescu and Dai and others have, and Dermer have sort of shown that the time index you expect is 2 plus the spectral index. So with a spectral index of 1 or 1.5, you get your 3 or 3.5 time index. So generally, these seems to work, except that it depends a little bit on the T naught. So even if you put T naught equal to the trigger time, it works in 30-40% of the cases, but you ask yourself, why doesn't it work in all cases? Okay, well, this is just here a little illustration of that's the line of sight emission coming from within 1/γ, then this is the high latitude emission from outside 1/γ, but still inside the jet. Okay, the jet is that. So I'm just sort of, I guess I should have shown the slide a little bit, but I explained it in words. So the actual slope will depend on where you take your time T naught, and actually it's possible to fit T naught such that the slope is satisfied, and Wei Liang et al. Have done that, and so here is an example of that. So you see, it's not all that easy to see, but the thing is that there are a whole bunch of steep decays, and you can do that also with the flares. The flares sometimes are also steep, and you can assume that there too you have this high latitude emission, and these vertical dashed lines are the value of T naught that you have to assume in order to fit the temporal slope. And so if you look at where the T naught necessary to fit the slope occurs, it usually occurs at the beginning of the rise time of the last flare. So the argument is that then, you had these internal shocks occurring at angles larger than 1/γ, and that comes in spikes, and then you take the last spike, and so T naught you take is the time at which these last spikes started to go up. And so that makes sense. So there is some support for this argument that you have this high latitude explanation. Okay. Well, there are some alternative things you can do. You can find constraints from T naught on the emission radius and other things. In general, the interesting thing, though, is that O'Brien et al. has made these actually 06 now, it's in AstroPH, has made the argument that these high latitude emissions seems to sort of fit quite decently with all the observations. So I think it's I wouldn't say it's a foolproof conclusion, but so far it looks consistent. Now, for the shallow decay portion, the simplest interpretation, which is I think likely, is that it's due to refresh shocks, meaning that you have your emission from the forward shock, which in principle would have been, as a normal steepness 1.3, but the thing is that the central engine may continue pumping out matter and energy, which arrives at the external shock and hits it from behind, so it gives it these little extra kicks, so that it cannot just drop at the normal adiabatic rate, but it's always being given a little extra energy, so it drops at a slower rate. These, you can have these if energy arrives later. It doesn't mean that the engine has to be on for all this time, because you could have an engine which was on just for a short time, 10 seconds, but it emits matter which has a range of Lorentz factors. The high Lorentz factor stuff is what will first decelerate and give you the normal forward shock. And then you have the lower Lorentz factor stuff, which was emitted also promptly, but it arrives later. So even though it's all promptly emitted, there is stuff that arrives late here, and that's what gives it, if it has more energy, it sort of gives it these additional little kicks. So, a space-time diagram shows how that might occur. You have stuff with the high Lorentz factor which starts to decelerate here, so the slope increases. Here you have the low Lorentz factor stuff which is moving slower, and it hits the forward shock out here. So if you have a range, then you would have stuff here that hits all over, and you can get these. Of course, if these late arriving material doesn't have a smooth distribution of Lorentz factors, but it comes in, discrete batches of discrete amounts of Lorentz factors, you might get bumps. And that could cause flares, but you can show that those would be flares which are relatively moderately rising and moderately decaying. So it's not these steep flares that are seen. This is just some little analytic expressions for the value of the temporal slopes you would get for different, distributions of Lorentz factors of the ejecta. Granat and Kumar have actually made a fit to the data of some of the shallow decays, and they find a distribution of Lorentz factors in the ejecta, and it's rather interesting. It's a broken power law, and so they find that most of the energy would appear to come at Lorentz factors of 40. It extends to Lorentz factors of 300 or whatever. That would be the initial forward shock, and then you have more energy at 40, and then it's sort of less at lower Lorentz factors. Now, one of the issues with these refreshed radiation, you told me to do this half an hour, but I'm running late. Okay. So the energy in the X-ray shallow emission is sometimes up to the value of the gamma ray prompt emission, so the fluence. Sometimes it's less, it never is more, but there is this interesting thing that, the fact that you put out so much energy in the X-ray shallow component as you do in the gamma rays is telling you something about the radiative efficiency in the two phases. And generally it has, if you argue that the gamma ray prompt emission is due to internal shocks, that's a bit worrisome, because it all calculations of the internal shocks have led to a radiative efficiency which is not very high. You have to sweat to get up to efficiencies of 10-30%. 5% is more like what you can do without sweating it too much, sometimes a few percent. On the other hand, the external shocks, they're typically more efficient. You have a very clean, high relative Lorentz factor situation, and you sort of get higher radiative efficiency. So you ask yourself, is there a problem here? And you have to argue either that the gamma ray emission has a higher radiative efficiency than the X-ray, which is contrary to the internal shock, although it might work for magnetic dissipation. Or maybe there is a fraction of the prompt emission which is undetected. That's, you know, completely speculative, but there could be a fraction, and there is an inverse Compton component. It could be in the GEV. We haven't observed that so far. I mean, you know, with CGRO, there were some observations, but we're talking of, you know, we didn't see these details as here. Or it could be that the one has a situation where in the afterglow, the fraction of the energy going into electrons or the efficiency, the shock parameters, they get better in time. So Kunihito, Yoka et al. Have argued these, and it's been also discussed by Granot et al. In this paper here. The other alternative that Granot et al. Discuss is that the kinetic energy that one associates with these gamma ray prompt emission may have been underestimated in Batsy bursts, and therefore, you know, in the current estimates, one may also have erred there, so that actually these relation there may not be as bad as it looks like. So there are a number of technical issues here that still are in discussion. I think that the explanation holds, but it's you know, it's something that has to be looked at, and one has to convince oneself a little more. Then there have been the X-ray flares. Now, some of them are discrete little flares which have few percent of the energy of the prompt emission, but some of them, one of them in particular, had as much energy in these giant X-ray flare as there was energy in the prompt gamma ray emission. I mean, this is rather unique, right? But it is an example, and here is a second flare which also, you know, well, it's much smaller, but this has as much energy as the prompt gamma ray emission. It's a factor 500 increase, and you can see it's a very steep rise, very steep decay, and it's very hard to explain these flares with that kind of steepness by arguing that the jet is running into some blob of external material. So, you know, if you do that, if you encounter, let's say, a density inhomogeneity, you will get a rise, but it will be, you know, a very rounded, slow rise and decay. Nothing this steep can be mimicked by encountering an external inhomogeneity. So you could argue that they're refreshed forward shocks. You don't encounter an external homogeneity, but from behind, you know, you have some late arriving material with which is, you know, rather short in time but has a lot of energy. Again, that will give you a flare, but not one that is as steep as that. So the decay will be shallower. And if it's only one flare you're talking about, it could be a reverse, you know, that you're seeing the reverse shock, and maybe the reverse shock is dominated by inverse Compton, so the optical radiation got kicked up to X-ray, but works only for one flare. It doesn't work for repeated flares, and generally even the steepness is for, you know, you can do some steepness of 3, but not 4 or 5. So by and large, by default almost, the explanation seems to be that there is continued central engine activity. In other words, that you continue having material that does internal shocks or does magnetic dissipation at the time of these flares, you know, so 10 to the 3 seconds, 10 to the 4 seconds. And, you know, there is a challenge for central engine models, but it's not crazy, because we know that, you know, from calculations of the collapse people, that if you form a black hole, and Chris Fryer can address these, but if you form a black hole in a collapsar, then there is continued infall that continues for, you know, certainly 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 seconds, albeit with decreasing amount of energy in it, but you can feed the black hole for a continued amount of time, and you can continue, you know, ejecting matter. So there have been other possibilities considered, which is, let me say, there's been another possibility that's been calculated by Andrew McFadden and Enrico Ramirez Ruiz and a third author, where they considered that, you know, maybe there is, but that was a flare in a short burst, and then they considered there is a binary. So for the long burst, I think I don't need to discuss that. Now, what could trigger these flares? Well, there is continued feeding of the black hole, but you still need to have things that you know, are very spiky. So the accretion would have to be spiky, or else. So how does that occur? So it may be that the accretion disk is fragmented by, you know, by instabilities or by lumpy accretion, and some of it has been calculated there. Alternatively, you know, it may be that the accretion is held, you know, it's dominated, the flow is dominated by MHT, and somehow the magnetic field holds it up, and then, you know, the accretion stops and, you know, re-expands and then goes back. So that might sort of induce a longer life, and Proga showed some calculations in the conference there. And then flares occur also in short bursts, and in short bursts it may have to do with the properties of the binary that's being disrupted. So I'll show a movie where a black hole neutron star binary seems to undergo some of these time-dependent accretions. So here is the program Begelmann simulation, which is an MHD simulation, and you see that, so here is the disk accreting inwards, and that's the jet going out, and you can see that, you know, it's lumpy. And so there is a time history of the lumpiness. So it's a qualitative type of, you know, behavior that looks like it, but there is no, you know, sort of one-to-one fit. So here is a quick summary of the party line sort of temporary explanations that are currently in vogue. You know, I think they're reasonable, but you know, it's work in progress. Some of these things may change. Some of them may change drastically. So far, these look like the reasonable best bet explanations. Now, there have been short bursts as well, and so the question is: are the afterglows essentially similar, or are there big differences? To first, to zero order, they look quite similar, interestingly. There are initial steep decays, there are X-ray flares, there's normal forward shock decay, there is even jet break in some cases. But then things are different, you know, at the first order. So the average kinetic energy per solid angle is smaller, significantly smaller. And the average jet angles, when there is a jet angle, you can infer, are larger by factors of 2 or 3, and in some cases by much more. So this is an example of a short burst X-ray light curve. That's the bat, the gamma ray, and here's the X-ray steep decay, and then somewhat flatter decay, and then flares, etc. And now, as you know, the hosts are something like 60% in ellipticals, and then the rest in irregulars, and one of them in a star-forming galaxy. So the fact that you find most of them in ellipticals is compatible with neutron star merger, neutron star black hole merger. It's also compatible, you know, with with the fact that some of them occur in spirals, in irregulars, because, you know, an old population you expect it also in spirals. There is, after all, a halo and a sort of nuclear component, so there are old stars there too. And some of the short bursts may in fact be soft gamma repeaters. The very nearby ones, you know, maybe up to 5% or 10% would have an energy which is adequate for soft gamma. So soft gamma repeaters have low energy. They're neutron stars, magnetars, it seems, but they have less energy, maybe 10 to the 48, 10 to the 47 at most, 10 to the 47, let's say. That's not enough to explain the 10 to the 49, 10 to the 50 erg short bursts, which are, you know, but you could see them at lower, you know, locally at lower distances. So there have been fits done to some of them, and Alin Panaitescu, who's here, has done fits here to two of the best studied short bursts. And, you know, he derives values of the opening angle and the jet energy, and does chi-squared fits. And so, you know, the solutions are not completely determined. The chi-squared has sometimes a low-density solution which has a different angle, and you have options, you know. So the chi-squared fits don't lead you to a unique solution all the time. Now, the interesting thing is that so these bursts had a break in X-ray or a break in the radio. Some bursts have been observed, 050724 has been observed at late times, both by Swift and by Chandra. So with Chandra late observations, there have been several Chandra late observations, and there is no break seen up to, you know, 10 days later. So there the outflow there seems to be pretty close to isotropic. In another burst, 1221A, so in X-rays there is no break. There was a break in third in the radio, I think, but, you know, that wasn't it wasn't a very well-studied light curve. The X-ray light curve is well-studied, and there is no break, not in X-rays at any rate. In another burst that's been looked at with Swift and two Chandra observations, there is a well-defined break in X-rays at 4 days, so you get a theta of 7 degrees and an energy of 2 × 10⁻⁴. That's collimation corrected, so that's not isotropic, but that's the total. So, you know, different things with different bursts. But even so, these, you know, larger than the average long burst opening angle. So the paradigm, the simple paradigm, is that it's neutron star, neutron star black hole mergers. It seems compatible with the hosts. Now, if you assume black hole neutron star mergers, here's a simulations of a Schwarzschild black hole with a neutron star around it, and there's a Kerr black hole with a neutron star around it. It's a prograde maximally rotating Kerr black hole. And look at the difference. Here the accretion is very fast, you know, the thing gets swallowed. Here the thing takes a longer time, gets disrupted, you get this tail. And in fact, there is, if you look at it carefully, there is a little, you know, there is a little separation, so you get sort of there's a little empty space between the accretion disk and the inner orbit. So you get sort of things that look like they could give you time structure. So these are calculations preliminary still of Laguna and Razio. It's SPH relativistic. And now let me just briefly go on the prompt optical afterglows. The expectation is that you get a reverse shock, which is optical, and it's very nice, initially brighter than the forward shock, which decays more slowly. So then in 99.0123, there was this initial steep decay that you expect from a reverse shock, and then the slower decay, and here was the gamma ray light curve, and here were the optical points seen by Rotzi, Akerlof. And but there were very few such bursts, especially until recently there was only one that was as bright as the canonically expected, you know, 9th or 10th magnitude, until recently 05, 09, 04, which had a comparable high magnitude. So 05, 09, 04 was a burst which was very difficult to trigger on, but it was triggered on thanks to our Los Alamos colleagues who made these very sophisticated trigger algorithms. You see, that's the gamma ray light curve, so it doesn't have, you know, it's not a simple way to trigger, but it does have a rise in the decay. That's how a usual low redshift gamma ray burst looks like, and that clearly looks like a time dilated burst. And then it was acquired with Sohr, then Reichardt et al. In photometry, and the photometry showed what looked like a Lyman drop there, which led to the inference that the photometric redshift was greater than 6. And then Subaru, 3.5 days later, measured spectroscopically the redshift of 6.29. And in X-rays, it's an extremely, well, it shows the more or less canonical behavior, steep drop, flares, messy stuff. But the thing is that a redshift 6.3, it's hugely bright in X-rays. Here at the beginning, it's 10 to the 5 times as bright as the brightest Sloan X-ray quasar, which is down here. That's a Sloan quasar multiplied by 100, just to get it in the picture. So initially, it's 10 to the 5 times brighter than the Sloan brightest quasar. And it's only after a day that the X-ray luminosity of these bursts becomes comparable to that of the brightest X-ray quasar. So as a tool for doing spectroscopic analysis of the high redshift intergalactic medium, this should be very interesting. It's a very high intensity source. And it was also detected promptly in optical by Tarot, Michel Breuer et al. Here's the Swift XRT light curve, and here's the Tarot optical light curve. Actually, it's near 10,000 angstroms, so it's I-band or whatever. So it's really infrared it's infrared in the observer frame, but it's optical UV in the rest frame. So it was as bright as 990123, about 9th magnitude. So compatible with the canonical picture of the reverse shock. And it also had a very high EISO, 10 to the 54 ergs, as 990123 had. And it was observed with this little 25-centimeter telescope, you know, which is delightful. Now, the big question is why only these two guys were that bright? I mean, there have been several more, maybe, 10 prompt detections, but they were all at 12, 13, 15 magnitude. There were only these two who were that bright. It may be that you need a very high EISO, like these two fellows had. Maybe that means that there was a very small collimation beam, and maybe the small collimation somehow leads to a very powerful reverse shock, or a reverse shock with the right properties of the radiation. If you detect it at higher redshift, maybe that's because the rest frame spectrum of the reverse shock is in the UV, and so then you maybe it's because there is a relativistic reverse shock. So maybe you need to be at high redshift to see it in the optical. But then 990123 was at a moderate redshift. It was 2.5 or 3 something. So, that's not necessarily the explanation. Of course, the rest frame spectrum should extend redwards of Lyman alpha. Otherwise, it will get absorbed. Maybe one needs a burst with strong flares. you know, maybe that's somehow associated with a very strong optical prompt emission. Maybe the reason why we don't see it in many bursts is that perhaps the optical flash is weak. It may be that in the ejecta, which is where the reverse shock moves, maybe you have foreign pairs, so that you're spreading out the same energy among more particles, so the typical radiation energy is more in the infrared, so, you know, as you go to high redshifts, you really don't see it. Or maybe the magnetic field in the ejecta is weak. Again, you sort of shift it to the infrared. Of course, if the reverse shock is very relativistic, it may shift it to the X-rays, and then you don't observe it because of that at low redshift, but you might sort of start seeing it at high redshift. Now, there have been four prompt optical flashes measured while the gamma rays were still in progress. The picture is mixed. In some of them, 050904 and 042019, the optical light curve correlates or seem to correlate with the gamma rays. So one could argue that the emission occurs from the same region. So maybe it's internal shocks during both, or, you know, the magnetic reconnection or whatever. But in some other bursts, 050401, 990123, there is no correlation between the optical and the gamma rays. So here, this was the initial case for saying that, oh, it must be a reverse shock. It doesn't correlate with the gamma rays, which are supposed to be internal shock. Makes sense. The optical does not correlate. But, you know, now we have these other bursts where it does correlate. So here is 990123. That's the optical, and that's the gamma rays. Doesn't correlate very well. But here is 042019, where the optical and the gamma rays correlate well. Here's a blow-up of that. The circles are the predicted optical emission based on the gamma ray spectrum extrapolated down to optical, and the crosses are the observation points, and you see that they're within one sigma. So they seem to be well correlated. That's what Westrand et al. Argue. So we have homework to do to understand these. And, well, the conclusions, you know, I think SWIFT is definitely expanding what we see of bursts, and I think we're, you know, modifying or expanding our understanding of afterglows. The basic paradigm of the afterglow and the prompt emission seem to be still within the what we had people had developed within the past 5 or 10 years, but with considerable extensions, and not all of them are well understood, and it may be that some of them will have to be modified significantly, or maybe new elements will have to be introduced. The MHD may play a big role, and that's been very poorly calculated so far. The flares will have to be, you know, modeled a lot more carefully to make sure, and the efficiency issue is something that will have to be, you know, tested out more carefully and in more detail over more bursts. And I think that, you know, the comparison between the short and long afterglows may give us some interesting information. Perhaps there is a correlation with the type of hosts, or maybe differences are due to, you know, the fact that one has these broader jet or etc. Clearly, it would be good to find breaks which are observed simultaneously at more wavelengths. And the optical flashes will clearly be something that need a lot more work. The interesting thing, though, as far as cosmology, I think we're finally getting to the position where we may be approaching the point where we can start using them as a tool. First, we'll have to understand the sources a little better, but it's getting to the point where we now have high redshift objects and we can, you know, start doing cosmology. Okay, thanks. I ate up all the discussion time.
Say something. was going to ask about the optical prompt emission again. I mean, these things would be much fainter than what the expectations were. So if you take sort of a standard model for a gamma ray burst and with the internal shocks, does that automatically produce an optical reverse shock emission at some level, or are there ways to totally avoid the optical emission that you seem to require?
This was the discussion there that I was, mentioning that, there are the hand-wavy ways in which you could imagine, with deformation or with relativistic reverse shocks, why the reverse shock emission is either weaker or it's shifted into wave bands, which are not the ones you can observe easily. So we still don't know which of these many alternatives is, or whether it is that it's not reverse shocks. I mean, if the ejector were strongly magnetized, pointing dominated, then you expect a very weak reverse shock, right? You have a high Alphine speed, so the reverse shock just is weak or non-existent. You would have a forward shock, so all that would work fine, and you could have, if it's pointing dominated, you could have reconnection, and that might explain then the prompt gamma ray emission, and that might have a strong optical component. But typically, if most of your energy is in the gamma rays, you have less in the optical. For an ejector which is not too strongly pointing dominated, you expect these, reverse shock more or less as in supernova remnants, and that canonical number gives you, that the emission should be near the optical if the epsilon Bs are not, are more or less standard. And you expect these something like ninth magnitude. So that was, quote, the canonical expectation. And it's, it's occurred in only two objects so far. But, with these hand wavy explanations, you can explain the 13th, 14th magnitude. But it's still uncomfortable that, why only, even the 13, 14 magnitude, that's only maybe 10 objects.
Yeah, aren't there some where it must be 18th magnitude?
Yeah,
or something?
Yeah, that's right. In some of them, it appears to be
large
totally
factors.
Absent. Yeah.
So it's a large factor.
Yeah. So clearly, this is one of the areas where we need to do a lot more understanding.
The fact that this 05, 09, 04 was just as bright as 99, 01, 2, 3, while it had a much larger redshift, isn't that, it means that it intrinsically was much brighter?
Well, the EISO is the same for both.
Ah.
Yeah. 10 to the 54-ish. We don't know.
Optical.
Yeah, the optical was ninth magnitude for both. But at redshift 6 versus redshift 3, you don't expect much of a that much of a weakening. 1.6. Okay, so factor 4. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's of course it's a different rest frame flux too, right? So I mean it's
I get further from the ultraviolet.
Yeah.
Well, after all, the original prediction, the original prediction was yours in your paper, but then there was a Piran Ansari prediction of a fifth magnitude for redshift 1, so these would be both fainter than that.
Mm-hmm.
So probably, 23, it is still acceptable that at redshift 6 you could observe a ninth magnitude according to that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, economical ninth magnitude is, pulling in values of epsilon B, epsilon E, etc. You can tweak them a bit and You know, I mean, I have to say that the canonical non-magnitude prediction, it was surprising that it came out to be exactly the same. You'd have thought maybe 10, maybe 8, you know. But so you can change around the magnitudes a little bit. But, you know, you would have expected something reasonably bright for the reverse shock. But, you know, as I say, if you make a lot of pairs or if the reverse shock is relativistic, you can really shift it to the either the infrared or the far UV. And so, but we don't have a quantitative handle on you know, actually getting an explanation, making, you know, a good calculation and fitting it over several bursts and getting a consistent explanation for why it's brighter and weaker in others.
May I ask a general question? Mm-hmm. If you see, what is your view toward the baryon load problem? I mean, where do we stand right now concerning the baryon load problem? Do you still see a problem with that, or do you think the models, the collapsar models, with this leading bow shock and trailing jet resolve the problem? Or
no, it's still a free parameter. It's you know, it's clear that you need high Lorentz factors observationally. It's almost unavoidable in order to see the 100 MeV and GeV photons. So, you know, that seems to be a fact. And what's the physics that causes much of the energy to be deposited in a region which is poor in baryons at the hand-wavy level is, you know, you can sort of think of it that, well, there is a black hole. Near the black hole, there are not so many baryons because they fell in. But the actual number is why it's 300, you know, or is it a spread of 300? We don't know, really. So so that part is quantitatively not well understood. Now the MHD schemes, again, they offer a qualitative way of arguing that, well, you get, you know, where you have magnetic fields, you know, the instabilities cause the magnetic fields to run out where they sort of in regions which are baryon poor. So, or the field lines that connect to the black hole are the ones that have not much baryons. But it's all sort of hand wavy. So, you know, one doesn't feel, I don't feel, you know, terribly worried about it, but I don't think anybody can give you a good ab initio calculation showing you that the baryon load has to be so much. I mean, you know, the calculations that Weichung Zhang and Stan Woosley et al. Have done of a hydrojet propagating through a star show that there is entrainment of matter from the sides of the jet. So even if you assume that the jet is baryon poor, so, you know, high entropy, not too many baryons, and the jet propagates, it will entrain some junk from the sides, from the star, so you'll get some baryon admixture. And modeling that would, you know, it's so the edges of the jet will be more slow, the central portion will be fast. So you get the natural explanation for why the jets might have angular structure where there is, you know, more energy at the center and less energy at the edges, or the Lorentz factor near the edges is lower. But you know, whether those calculations are sufficient to actually calculate you know, a good baryon load, I think at the moment, no.
So what is your feeling for the angular dependence of the gamma ray?
Sorry?
What is your feeling about the angular dependence of the gamma ray?
Well, you know, there is this simple fit that you can make that of the distribution of E isovers or jet breaks that suggests that, that there is a theta to the minus 2 dependence of the energy. And Lazzati and Begelman have come up with, you know, some calculation which justify these both analytically and numerically. And if you look at the Weichung Zhang and Woosley calculations, they seem to agree. You get some structure like that. Actually, a Gaussian-type jet, you know, a jet that sort of is not necessarily, so you have a core, but then you have a decay. You know, the decay part I think it would be hard to tell whether it's Gaussian or theta to the minus 2 from the data. You can get fits with both. And then if you start to you know, try to put in the X-ray flashes in the same scheme as the gamma ray bursts, then you find that the theta to the minus 2 jets could not extend all the way to X-ray flashes. You would have to have a more a faster decay at large angles. So there, something like a Gaussian jet with a mean opening angle of, let's say, 8 degrees plus or minus 3 seems to be, you know, what fits the data. So there is room there for both data analysis and you know, numerical simulations to improve much.
Could be due to this curved
emission.
You have a picture of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have most of the radiation comes from the line within the line of sight inside 1/γ, and then you have other prompt emission, which you know, is at angles larger than the causal angle, and you have a different Doppler factor out there. It's dominated by the angle rather than by the Lorentz factor term. So if you look at the Doppler factor, you know, it has a sine theta term and you know, a Lorentz factor. So the dependence is such at this high angle that, you know, it's hard to sort of, it comes out to be that, you know, these decay T is 2 plus, you have 2 more factors of the time index plus the spectral index.
Is the radiation cone then wider than the cone in which the matter is
ejected? Yeah, so you argue that the jet angle is wider than the light cone, 1/γ. And so the stuff, so you see most of the prompt radiation coming from inside the light cone. What's outside the light cone, you still get some of that, but in the prompt emission, it's at much lower intensity. And then it comes later and more redshifted. So what was gamma rays looking that way appears to as X-rays to you at a later time. And I don't have a good sort of simple, you know, one-line explanation for it. But if you go through the details, it gives you these 2 plus beta index.
Ensure that the opening angles are different for the short
long bursts? Well, the opening angles have been calculated for 4 bursts. So if you call, you know, statistics with 4 examples, if you call that satisfying, you know, you would argue that, yes, they seem to be at least a factor of 2 broader than the mean angle of the long bursts. So the ones where it's been actually a jet break measured, there may be a factor of two or three larger than the mean angle of long burst, and then in one short burst has been apparently no break. So it's, you know, maybe much larger. All right, so these two, except that one had a radio break. Aline, I forget, it was a radio or an optical break? Radio break.
Yeah, so and this is actually, you should be talking it off, because you later show it there.
That's right.
It's not there.
Yeah. And
the one
105, 12, 21A.
You have optical measurements that show no break to day 6.
All right, but you have an X-ray, a very good X-ray break. These Chandra observations.
It's a comet.
That's may well be. Yeah.
So I would say that you actually only had one example.
How well sampled is the optical no break, or the optical?
It's a Gemini data point every day for 30 days.
Okay.
So there are no detection at the end. Mm-hmm. It glides smoothly as far as it is.
Uh-huh.
You can also take off of 7.4 because of the channel rate observation of the
instrument. Yeah, so you end up with a very shaky evidence project. I wouldn't say that there's evidence for logic.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, you would argue that, you know, they're uncollimated.
Yeah.
That not just twice as broad, but, you know, quite very broad. But in that case, I guess we have to find a different explanation for the X-ray break, because the X-ray breaks, they, you know, look like the optical breaks look when they appear.
Yeah.
So it may be that there are two component jets, as was argued, you know, before, for at least one burst, where you had a radio break which came at a different time than the optical breaks. So that will be a different ball game, but it's, you know, one that's is not unreasonable.
When I talked to Thomas about the jet stuff they've been doing in VA, if you told me that there was no break and there was no beaming, then that would be very hard. Interesting is they expect beaming.
Mm-hmm.
They get it from that torus. So they get the same kind of confining. No MHD, just the confining of the gas got them fairly, you know,
mm-hmm.
a few beaming like what you got from the long range here. So
yeah. In a hydro calculation.
Yeah. So it's just a hydro. I mean, so you cannot kind of see that as the minimum amount of beaming.
Yeah.
Unless there's something magical going on and they don't understand it.
Yeah, right.
But that would, you know, so if there is no beaming, that kind of seems like it rules out that number.
Well, but they did neutron star mergers, I guess. One would have to try still the neutron star black hole mergers. And one would have to see whether MHD effects make a difference. But yeah, I mean, you would sort of be a little bit predisposed against the neutron star merger.
I mean, if there are beams, like you were espousing, then it would be okay.
Mm-hmm.
That would be what they expect.
So. Mm-hmm.
I would now need more of my 700, double than it's also. Maybe it's not pulled out, but it's painful, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I wouldn't say it's the best fit.
Yeah.
But then again, it's also, there are not a set of the holes. So.
Yeah, the neutron star black hole mergers have appeared a little more attractive because they offer the possibility of these lumpy accretion. And also, you get a little more energy, you know, things like that.
But the problem is that we don't know when you can start black hole binary. I mean, we only know them theoretically, but the little neutron stars, we are 8 or 9.
Yeah.
So we can do something.
Right.
Are the isotropic inferred energies for the ones that show no jet break higher? So the ones that look like maybe they really are isotropic, what are the isotropic equivalent energies?
I would have to go through the numbers.
Well, this one case, though, 05218, the one at the bottom, well, these numbers are compatible if they're the optical measurements by solar metal that show no jet break would push this one up to about 30 to 50 or something like that, maybe a little bit more. So of course, if there's a two-component jet or something more complicated, then that would not hold. But if you assume that the X-ray break is something else, then that one would indeed be slightly more energetic than the
Can I ask about the X-ray light curves, the flares, and the shallow behavior? I mean, with the shots, they could be either do a range of Lorentz factors or late engine activity. With the flares, talked about the late engine activity, you do that with sort of a range of Lorentz factors from the initial burst and everything just gets right, or is that rather contrived?
Oh, you mean to combine the Lorentz factors needed for the shallow decay to...
I don't know. I'm wondering if you see both types of behavior in the same objects, or is it different in different objects also in that transit? Because
generally, when you see the steep decay and the shallow decay, you only observe the flares when there has been a steep decay and a shallow decay. Sometimes there is a normal decay and then there are no flares. So So when you have this, when you have the normal decay, then it's as if the flares would have been sticking below it. So you either get this thing here.
So you're saying that if it's normal, the flares would really show up against it, or they're just not there?
That's what, you know, so graphically, that's what it looks like, yeah. And this here, slope of -1 or -1.2 or something like that. And, you know, so that's what the -1.2 that goes over there. So in some bursts you seem to get that, in some bursts you seem to get that, and then, you know, maybe you get the break. So this is telling us something, but it's not yet quite put together what it is telling us.
I think that there is no clear case of a flare on a shallow decay. When we see those flares, they either are the beginning of the shallow decay and, you know, very few cases at the end of it, like little curious things that are not from, but not in the middle of the shallow decay.
The giant flare was in the middle.
It's almost the beginning of the decay, it's not in the middle.
Well,
it seems like it's objective.
Yeah. Opa, there he is. Well, I suppose it's...
And then there are a couple of heads after those that are Mamonian players.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, 05, 09, 04, yeah, seems to be just all flares. You have the steep decay and then, right. Upper. Well, yeah, it depends on, of course, here there was, you know, the orbit occultation, so it depends on whether you call these you know, shallow decay, but then there is, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Okay, it's time again.
Thank you.